Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with E. Sean Russell, who's the operations officer for the Extropy Institute and an electronic musician. Sean, how did you first get involved in electronic music?
Electronic music actually came about when I was, about 16. I went to a really interesting high school. I went to what was called a fine arts school. I had actually relocated to the Vancouver's Lower Mainland at that point, and I went to school in this fine arts school, and it was actually more, it was almost like a college in that it had majors. You could major in music, drama, dance, or visual art. And initially I was of course a music major, but then I eventually decided I didn't want to be a music major for various reasons and went into drama. But they also had other courses that were based on any of the individual arts as well, and one of them was electronic composition. And so I took it because I didn't want to forego the music aspect of my education altogether, so I decided to give it a shot, and it turned out I fell in love with it, and started to, it was kind of funny because all the compositions I would do, like I'd never really composed before, so when I started to do it, there are all these sort of methods that people are supposed to do when they start doing their compositions that I had no real knowledge of, so I just composed with what I felt was good. So I wound up doing these 10-minute-long epical pieces that have multiple parts and stuff like that, and the rest of the people in the class would do more classical-sounding thing because they had a more comprehensive musical education. But once I started doing some actual composition in there, I just fell in love with it, and I realized it was something I really wanted to carry on for long term. It just really woke something up in me. I would spend hours after school just going into the music lab and working on pieces. It was great too because we had a really good setup with a computer. We had Cubase Score, which is what I still use to this day. Actually, a very old version of Cubase Score because this was back in '95. And I still actually use the same version, even though Cubase has been updated multiple times since then. And they also had Korg keyboards, which incidentally I use now too. So it was kind of nice that it was such a professional setup as well. And that I think really meant a lot. I've never really used anything else substandard beyond Korg keyboards and the Cubase programs.
Let's listen to a piece of your music called Dogs of Ganymede.
Sure.
Why did you choose to compose in the electro-ambient genre? I mean, what What's the attraction? You said that your musical education was restricted, but you knew that there were other genres out there, and you were involved for a while with heavy metal, I guess.
Yeah, it was. I used to actually really enjoy, probably more so than heavy metal, I'd say progressive metal. I kind of enjoyed bands like Dream Theater and various stuff. Actually, I still listen to a diverse amount of genres today. But one thing I did find with the electronic genre, or just being a keyboardist in general, I found it when you're doing most genres of music, pretty much have electric guitar as the center of the genre, and it's the one instrument of all, you know, of all the main band instruments that I could never really get a grasp on. I can play drums fairly well, and I can get by on bass, but it was just I could never really become very good on electric guitar. And so I decided that most of my music, in the absence I didn't have a guitarist, I decided I would pretty much do music that didn't really require a guitar. So now I do more electronic ambient pieces, but I still try to branch off into as many genres as possible without having a guitar player. I've done a variety of work with guitarists, but it's not, for some reason I just don't get the same enjoyment out of it, because I don't have the full ability to mastermind a composition when you're working with other musicians.
A lot of the original inspiration, like Brian Eno's inspiration for doing ambient music, was to kind of build a soundtrack for life. You couldn't be dancing all the time, and a lot of life required just more background noise. Were you inspired by partly that vision, or was it more, were you actually trying to do orchestral listening music, but with a more calming orientation?
It's funny because it sort of just pops out. It's not really something I think a lot about. It's when I sit down to do a piece. Actually, the best way for me to put it is this way. Often I will sit down and I'll write a piece, and I'll like before I even do any recording or anything like that. I'll sit down and I'll usually with piano setting or whatever. I'll sit down and write a piece, and I'll think, "Wow, you know, this will be great when I actually record it." But when I sit down to record it, it just doesn't even capture any of the essence of the piece that I had envisioned in the first place. And so, often when I sit down to write a piece, something will just happen. I'll be playing with a bass line, and then suddenly that'll form the whole basis of the song, and everything will grow out of that initial inspiration. And it's sort of a branching off of some beginning of an inspiration. It's more so than something I actually think about the whole time I'm doing it. It's more instinctual than anything, I think. It just flows out of me. It's not something I think too much about.
I want to talk to you about your Extropy Institute involvement, but I want to play another piece as an introduction to that. Let's listen to Human Accomplishment, which seems like a good introduction to your work with the Extropy Institute. speaking with E. Sean Russell. He's the operations officer for Extropy Institute and the composer of the electronic music that we're listening to now. Sean, you got involved with the Extropy Institute a number of years ago. How did that come about, and what was your inspiration to become a confirmed Extropian?
Well, back in about August of 95, I sort of had a mimetic awakening, if you will, sort of a something sort of snapped into place when I read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which I know is considered an extremely influential book by a lot of people. But that sort of put things into place for me. I sort of realized that I had it just awakened a sort of sense of life in me. I never actually went on to become an objectivist or anything like that. Something in me sort of clicked. And when I was first introduced to Extropianism just by a friend of mine who showed me an article from Wired magazine, I just thought, gee, this is sort of the logical next step. I felt that once you have the the confidence and understanding of the present, why not attribute that to the future? And so the Extropian principles I found were pretty much flawless as a document. And so I joined when I got a modem, I joined the Extropians list in the middle of 96, and have been a contributor to that list ever since. I actually became the list administrator about a year ago, but I just really, really thought the ideas were very, well, right. I just didn't see any flaw in the visions of attributing individualism to the future and promoting progress as opposed to naysaying and that kind of thing.
Now, the principal author of the Extropian Principles, although it's been a collaborative project over the years, has been a fellow named Max Moore. He's the director of the Extropy Institute. What is the Extropy Institute in addition to Max Moore? I mean, he has a very clear vision for it, it seems. But what other projects, and there's a board of directors, is it a more collaborative thing than just a vision of one man?
It is definitely more collaborative. It is definitely seen as Max's project. I think on publicly it's more seen that way, but it is definitely more of a collaborative project. I know the board of directors does talk a lot, and ultimately any major decision is made by the board of directors. For example, just various directions that the or various things that the Institute has done in the last number of years. It's been more than just Max doing it. I mean, Max is definitely the main person at EXI. There's no question about that. But there is definitely a lot of input from other people mm-hmm. in that as well.
What's your role now as the operations officer?
I do all the membership inquiries. I take care of anything that anyone has to ask about the Institute. That kind of thing. If people become members of EXI, I take care of that process. I also administrate the main mailing list. I helped organize the last conference back in June, and made sure that ran smoothly. And various administrative things like that. I pretty much take care of all the administrative details. And I also provide. I talk to Max on a regular basis. I also provide a little bit of direction, or at least a little bit of input as to my thoughts on what Extropy Institute can do to both increase membership as well as expand the philosophy into a larger market.
Now, Extro 5 occurred this summer. You've had an annual conference for Extropy Institute-type folks. This one seemed pretty successful.
It's actually pretty much biannual.
Biannual?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this one had Ray Kurzweil and a number of other folks.
Yeah, Ray Kurzweil was our keynote speaker. We were really happy to get Ray. Initially, he had said that he wouldn't be able to make it, but he would do something virtual. So he's going to have a presentation over the internet, real time, but over the internet from his home in Massachusetts. But he actually did decide to fly out. So it was. He got there quite literally about 5 minutes before his presentation started. So he's
quite an important exponent of these ideas now. He's coming out with a book called The Singularity is Near, as I understand.
Yeah, Singularity is Near. He talked a lot about some of the things that are in that book. Also, Ray is really well known for his last book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. And he's actually, in almost every way, Ray is quite an amazing guy. He's done a lot of things. He essentially created the Kurzweil music synthesizer, which is probably, with the exception of Korg, it's probably the best, the most widely used keyboards nowadays, or the highest quality keyboards. He's done lots of things with voice recognition software, and he's quite an interesting guy, so we're really happy to have him for Extra 5.
His website's mind-blowing.
Kurzweil, yeah, his website with Ramona and all that. Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. If ever you want to go somewhere for some good eye candy and mind candy, just go to kurzweilai.net. And he's also an advisor of Extropy Institute as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Extropy Institute has a journal, the Extropy Journal. How's that going?
Exponents. That's good. Basically, I write that. I write that on the second Sunday of every month. It goes out to primarily members only, and a few other people as well. And that pretty much just says current news and happenings within Extropy Institute. What certain extropians are doing, media coverage that various people have had. And things like that. It's good. I enjoy writing it. I get a lot of input from other people. I'm pretty much the editor of it as well. And that's good. It's going out to more and more people each month, because we definitely have not slowed in getting members now.
There have been a number of anti-technological pieces of legislation floated in this Republican Congress and Republican presidential administration. The anti-stem cell decision recently, it's a compromise that's going to restrict stem cell research, bills against cloning and so forth. And I understand that the Extropy Institute is supporting or backing or helping to create a new PAC, a political action committee, to support pro-technological lobbying.
You're talking about PROACT. That is separate from Extropy Institute, but it is something that's supported by Extropy Institute and has a lot of pretty much the majority of the members right now of PROACT are people who are also involved with Extropy Institute. There's myself. There's Natasha. Natasha Vita Moore is the main person, the driving force behind it. But there's also Max Moore is involved, as well as Greg Birch. He's the vice president of Extropy Institute, and Harvey Newstrom, who's just recently become a director of Extropy Institute as well.
Does PROACT have an agenda yet, a tightly focused agenda, besides defending life extension technology?
It's in the process of being worked on right now. It hasn't been completed. It was introduced at Extra 5, and for a few specific reasons, it has sort of... wouldn't say stalled, but it's just in stasis right now for a couple reasons.
Let's listen to a piece that you composed on the occasion of the death of one of the most prominent of Extropy's members, Sasha Chislenko. Do you want to say a bit about who Sasha was?
Yeah, Sasha was he was a really great guy. he was probably the with the exception of Greg Birch and Natasha Vita Moore, he had a lot of drive to bring a lot of these ideas to more people. And
he's a Russian immigrant.
He was a Russian immigrant, and he'd had sort of an unfortunate past. He'd had a lot of bad things happen to him in Russia and before his immigration over here. But he was just very, very action motivated, and he was just a really nice guy as well. And it was actually his death that really prompted me to change my focus and take a more active role with the Extropy Institute, which I did very soon after. So the piece Sasha is sort of my tribute to him. I don't think it really does any justice to Sasha, but I do. It was a very natural piece. It just felt right to write.
Let's listen to that now. Thank you. This is Dr. J with Chain Surfer Radio, and I'm speaking today with E. Sean Russell, the Operations Officer for Extropy Institute and an electronic musician. When Sausage Shizlenko died, I understand that it came as a great shock to many that he had not made plans for cryonic suspension, and that's something that many people involved in the extropy circles are doing, is signing up to be frozen when they suffer their temporary deaths. You are an exponent of that. How did you get involved in cryonics, and what are your current plans?
Well, basically, back in January, I had talked to Max Moore about the possibility of me coming down to Southern California from where I was based in Vancouver, and I was interested in working with some progressive technology, something along the lines of either nanotechnology or in the cryonics field. And it just so happened that that within a couple of weeks of me talking to Max, Max discovered that a fellow who'd been involved with cryonics for many, many years, Mike Darwin, had was planning on starting a new cryonics organization, but didn't have a person that would be able to do the operational side of it, the more administrative stuff. And so as a result, Max said to Mike that well, he's got this good person in mind for that, and hooked me up with Mike, and eventually in March of this year I did come down, and we co-founded Cryos Biomedical. I've long been a proponent of cryonic suspension, or cryopreservation, as some people call it. The reason for that is that I find any chance is better than no chance. I think if a person really enjoys their life and would like a chance, and I'm not saying it's essentially a very good chance, but if they want a chance at having you know, perhaps living in the future, then I don't see a reason not to. You can pay for it through your life insurance policy, and that I think it just makes sense. I wouldn't put the chance as being extremely high that people will come back out of it, but I think any chance is better than no chance. I would opt for, if there's a 10%, and I'm not saying there is any real objective percentage that a person can attribute to it. But if there is a 10% chance or a 15% chance, that's a heck of a lot better than being ashes in the wind or being a buried body sort of thing.
It's very amusing to me that in the latest issue of Scientific American, which is devoted to nanotechnology, a technology that they had previously poo-pooed as being pie in the sky, they do celebrate the advances in nanotechnology, but great pains in several of the articles to distance themselves from Eric Drexler and Ralph Merkel's connection of nanotechnology to cryo reanimation, the possibility of putting back together the broken pieces of a frozen body. And so obviously that idea still holds a lot of terror in the hearts of the scientific establishment.
Yeah, it's... I think you'll see the same thing with a lot of technologies that were cutting edge a number of years ago, or a lot of technologies that weren't invented at the time. I can't think of any off the top of my head, I'm afraid. But a good example is actually the artificial heart that we're seeing just now by Abiomed. Recently, there was the Jarvik heart, artificial heart that's been around for a while, but. But just recently, with this whole deal with a BioCore being this artificial heart that they've put into a person, that if it does work, and by all accounts they're keeping the results fairly private. But as far as we know, the patient that's been implanted in hasn't died or anything like that yet. But that's just one example of how technologies that people are scared of or people don't think will work, sometimes when they actually do get put forth and put into a person, then people start to realize, well, hang on a second, maybe this isn't such a bad thing. And I think the same thing is true of nanotechnology. There will be the times where people will denounce nanotechnology and say it's absolutely alien, it's atrocious, it's a terrible thing, and there will be bans on it in various ways, I'm sure. by various governments around the world, saying it's unethical and amoral and all that kind of thing. But eventually, as pretty much all technology that we have right now has done, it'll make its way through and it'll become eventually, gradually, painfully mainstream. And but yeah, as with most technologies in their infancy, there is a lot of crying about it by the by scientists and all that, and by the public, which is perhaps more important. And but eventually, most of these things seem to come through anyway.
We're out of time, but I want people to go to your mp3.com site and listen to the other songs on your various tracks, and you'll be announcing your new album that will be coming out in a while on that mp3 site, I assume.
Yes, the album is called Reality's Twin, and it's a concept album revolving around the concept of reality and the fragmentation thereof, various aspects and themes of each individual song in the album will be repeated in others, and should be done before the end of the year, I think.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with E. Sean Russell. He's the operations officer for Extropy Institute and an electronic musician whose music can be listened to at mp3.com. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.